Right, Josepha Madigan, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown and Minister of State for Special Education and Inclusion is on the line now. She's visiting us here in Kildare. Minister, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Owen.
We'll talk about your purpose of your visit to Kildare in just a moment, but I just want to pick up on something that's been in the headlines over the last 24 hours. We covered it on the programme this morning as well, with the Teachers Union of Ireland, Michael Gillespie, the General Secretary, saying there's a chronic underfunding of education, and that's putting huge pressure on both schools and parents. And we heard from Bernardo's as well, that saying that parents are worried about meeting the back-to-school costs this year. And, you know, we talked about the, I suppose, the cost that it's costing people to send their children back to school. You're working in the education area. What would you say to those parents who are struggling, worried about uniforms, worried about books, worried about iPads, etc.?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank Bernard Durkin for inviting me down to Kildare and visiting two schools. And I know we're going to talk about that in a minute, Scully Reid and Primrose Hill National School. Just, I mean, I can completely understand. I have two school-going children myself. One has just finished school, actually. And I know how expensive it is when they're going back to school, whether it's clothing or footwear or transport even. And, you know, the government recognised that. So in advance of the budget, we actually put in a suite of measures which were designed to help families. So there was €100 extra on the back-to-school clothing and footwear allowance, and that's going to help about 120,000 families.
Is it enough, though, if it's costing €814 to send a first-year secondary school student to school, €100 off that, it's still going to cost €714? Could more be done?
I think it varies, you know. I mean, there's 212,000 children, actually, in total, 150,000 families who will benefit from this. But, you know, what the government has said is that it will constantly be monitoring the situation vis-a-vis the budget coming up in September. But it's important to say as well that, you know, there's a hot school meals programme as well, which was expanded to 310 new DESH schools. So there's 1,800 DESH schools in the country. That's going to help about 290,000 children. And for the first time ever, school transport is free effectively, and that's at a cost of $289 million this year for families, and anyone who's already paid will be refunded. I mean, the government had in February clearly announced a revised cost, but now all fees have been waived. You know, in uniforms as well, I mean, I think that can be a burden on parents as well, and there was a circular sent to schools which asks them to take a sort of a cost-effective approach when they're talking about school uniforms. So to advise parents to buy, you know, generic uniforms, you know, that could be purchased from an array of different retailers. Mm. So only sort of an iron-on or a sew-on type of crest.
And Bernardo's are calling for that circular to be implemented because it was sent out in 2017, and they're arguing that some schools are not following that, so perhaps there needs to be more oversight. When it comes to underfunding of schools that the Teachers Union of Ireland are saying, that means that schools are meeting these shortfalls through voluntary contributions, and some people would say that these contributions are not voluntary, that they're kind of compelled to pay these contributions. How can we alleviate the pressure on parents that way?
Yeah, well, I mean, the voluntary contribution, I mean, it says what it says on the tin, effectively. Voluntary is voluntary by its very nature. And even though schools can seek it, there should be no compulsion to pay. And obviously, no child's pay should be dependent on a willingness to pay. And they shouldn't be shamed into paying. And you know, we've made that very clear to schools. And that circular did go to schools around the school uniforms. And there are as well, you know, in relation to school books, which, of course, can be extremely expensive as well for parents. You know, the schools have been asked again to adopt a sort of a cost-conscious approach around the selection of books. I mean, there is a book rental scheme which is worth about $17.2 million that we put in place back in 2021, and 96% of primary schools and 69% of post-primary schools operate a book rental scheme to parents. So we're hoping that that will help. And I know the Bernardo's report back in 2019, they did a real cost of school report, which stated that €85 was the average cost of school books at primary school level. And under that circular, you know, we brought it up by an extra €21. So that should help in terms of the book scheme, you know. But we are we are very conscious of it, and the fact that we have a cost of living crisis as well.
It's the latest kick.
It's
the latest kick in the teeth for people, really, because, you know, school starts back in the next month or so. We've seen over the last couple of months the pressure people have when they're going shopping. They're filling up their trolleys less. The energy crisis as well, with price there as well. So with this cost of living crisis and the government saying that you're not going to introduce measures prior to the budget to take the pressure off people, should something not be done in the meantime? Why are we waiting until the budget?
Well, I think it's wrong, first of all, to say that we haven't put any measures in place prior to the budget, because we did. I mean, there was €1 billion.
Put in
the last budget. Well, there will be obviously measures in the next budget, but you know, there's been a total of €2.4 billion package put in place. Like, there's €125 for those in the fuel allowance. That helps about 372,000 people. There's 20 cents off the petrol and 15 cents off diesel. There's the €200 electricity credit. That is reduced to 9%. We have about 2.5 million back at work at the moment. And unfortunately, we know that the underlying factors for inflation, you know, are international and unfortunately beyond our control. But we did take action before other countries. The global economy was already facing inflationary pressures from COVID. But we have to do everything we can. And main point, I think, is the fact that, you know, we managed the economy soundly over the years, and that's why we were in a position to help people during COVID. And we want to try to help them now so that they can try and live. And the government will continue to respond if needs be. And I think, it is very difficult for parents and for families out there at the moment. I think everybody notices it, in their daily shopping or in anything that they're doing from day to day.
Okay, I want to move on to the issue of SNAs, special needs assistance, and an article that was circulated about 3 or 4 weeks ago where SNAs are being asked to carry out, in quotes, demeaning work in some schools, and they've criticised school directives which allegedly required them to complete tasks outside their job description, such as laying concrete and cleaning fish tanks in an Oireachtas meeting. Representatives from the Force of Trade Union met with yourself about a month ago. Were those meetings constructive?
Yes, I think you're referring to the committee hearings that we had. I think I had a two-hour meeting maybe on SNAs specifically, but yeah. I mean, the exploitation of SNAs is something obviously that I never want to see. They're absolutely crucial for children with additional needs. Obviously, the majority of children with additional needs attend mainstream school, but obviously there is a minority there who have significant need for care support and who simply wouldn't be able to attend school without their SNA, and they develop a very close relationship with them.
Are SNAs underappreciated in the education system, do you think?
Well, first of all, just to say they're recruited specifically to assist schools in helping children. It's very important to me that their work is recognised, and we've been talking about moving towards accreditation in the future. And obviously, one of the first things I had to do following the National Council of Special Education report in 2018 was to set up a training course for them. So the very first national training programme for SNAs started in UCD, and we did about 3,500 SNAs who will graduate from that. And once we have that review, then we're going to be looking at the evaluation report and perhaps looking at raising the minimum qualification, which I know Forza has raised, and obviously the consideration of accreditation. I mean, they're huge support. We know that in each special class, for example, we have two SNAs for six children in a primary class and 2.5 SNAs then in a post-primary class. But the work that they do is extremely important, and, you know, it's quite exhausting work as well, even though I'm sure it's really fulfilling in many ways. They've had a difficult time during COVID. In fact, the whole community, education community has, and we're very conscious of that, and I certainly am myself.
Okay, the summer provision as well, which I know you would work quite a lot with and closely with schools and SNAs on that. Mark Wall, Senator here in Kildare of Labour, was calling that perhaps next year we should see summer provision in at least the majority of towns in every county in order to keep that routine for children with special needs. And that's all well and good calling for that and saying that, and the government saying, yeah, we'll do our best to do it. We have to pay people. We have to pay teachers. We have to pay SNAs the correct amount of money in order to carry out the summer provision during July. Is there going to be a commitment from government that we can do that perhaps next year?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, I want to thank the two schools in Kildare, and I know there's other schools as well, but Scully Reid in Kilcock and Primrose Hill National School in Selbridge that I'll be visiting today for the sole purpose to meet the staff and principals and SNAs and indeed the children who are participating in the summer provision. Mm. I mean, it's a great way for children to maintain that connection with education and sort of build their confidence and increase their motivation and, I suppose, promote their well-being, particularly at key transition stages. And, you know, we got a report from the Summer Provision last year. We put 40 million into this programme every year. We have about 1,000 schools this year participating in it. But I would like to see more schools do that. And we took measures to try and encourage schools to do that, and including in relation to the pay. So, you know, the staff get an extra week's pay, so there's a double of their salary if they participate in some provision. We also allow them have flexibility around when they could host that programme, just to try and encourage more people to take it up. But we're confident that we'll have about 48,000 children who should be participating in it this summer, and it's of a massive, massive support to them and indeed to their families as well that they go and attend.
Okay, just before we let you go then, Minister, as we said from the outset and you've touched on there, you're in Kildare visiting Scully Reid in Kilcock and Primrose Hill in Selbridge, and I know those meetings are going to start very shortly, so we will let you go. But the purpose of your visit, as you say, the summer provision schools taking place there, but what else are you planning to do here in Kildare?
Yeah, so Bernard Durkin, who's very interested in special education, I work very closely with him, invited me down to visit these schools. I know in Kildare, for example, we have about 103 special classes, and 9 of those are new primary special classes opening in September, and 5 post-primary special classes. And I want to thank all of the schools who are opening special classes, because obviously that's something that I've been calling for a significant period of time. I'm really looking forward to meeting Seamus O'Meara, the principal of Scully Reid in Kilcock, and also the principal Caroline Flood in Primrose Hill and Selbridge, both of them are providing the summer provision. And I think it's going to be really interesting to hear their feedback, how they find it, how it works for the children, and you know, it's a great opportunity for me to come outside of Dublin and travel around the country and understand, you know, firsthand from the school staff themselves, what we can do and what can be improved, and how it works on a day-to-day basis during the summer.
Okay, Fine Gael, TD for Dublin Rathdown and Minister of State for Special Education and Inclusion, Josepha Madigan. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning, and good morning to you. And yeah, messages coming in, I suppose, in relation to what we were talking about there, the cost of living, the pressure that parents are feeling with the going back to school costs. And as I said, it's just the latest kick in the teeth, because 2 or 3 months ago, it was to do with the price of food going up, the price of fuel going up, and now we see the school costs rising as well. A listener has been in touch to say the July provision is fantastic, but the minister and others don't understand. Some children with special needs just cannot understand having no school. The listener understands, obviously, staff need holidays, but these children just can't understand the stopping of a school routine. Even if it was 3 days a week, these children don't understand a summer holiday. And I put that point to the minister, that it's a routine for these children with special needs. They get up in the morning, they go to school, even if it's for a couple of hours, that is their routine, and we need to see it being implemented in more towns around Kildare, and more schools need to bring it forward as well. But as we also said, those staff that are carrying out these jobs need to be paid well and reimbursed for the work that they're doing. Otherwise, it's not worth their while, they would say, to do these school school provisions. Another one here saying another load of blah blah from the minister. The parents haven't got your salary and expenses, according to Joy. The burdens that are being sent on people going back to school as well. And another listener there as well saying that there's just statistics and millions being mentioned, but not real information. But that is Josepha Madigan, the Minister of State for Special Education and Inclusion.
Kildare Today
with Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. Whitewatersc.ie.
Well, Clwyd Housing opens applications for 50 new cost rental homes in Newbridge today, with rents approximately 25% to 30% below market value. And discussing this with us now is David Murphy. He is new business manager with Clwyd Housing, and he's on the line. David, good morning and welcome to Kildare Today.
Hi Owen, how are you?
I'm not too bad. So we'll get to the details then about these cost rental homes in a moment, but just explain that term to us for people who might not be aware of it, or might not be aware that they are eligible for cost rental homes. What exactly does it mean?
Yeah, so basically cost rental is a new form of long-term kind of secure rental offering that has been introduced by the government under their Housing for All programme. So basically it's really targeted towards middle-income earners, people who are, you know, earning too much for social housing supports, but maybe aren't in a position to be able to rent privately or to buy for themselves. So it's really that kind of middle-income threshold that it's targeted towards.
Okay, and these homes in Newbridge, they're in the paddocks. Tell us a little bit about the paddocks and the houses that you're offering.
Yeah, so Clwyd have been working with the developer in the paddocks there over the last number of years. So overall, there's 300 homes within the estate, a mixture of apartments and houses. So Clwyd are now launching 50 new apartments today. They're a mix of 1, 2 and 3 beds. So we have 10 one beds, 36 two beds and 4 three beds. So they're brand new apartments. Are coming to towards the end of construction, and we expect we'd be in a position to hand over keys to tenants probably in about October of this year.
Right, and I said at the outset there, rents approximately 25% to 30% below the local market value. So how much are we talking here for those apartments, one bed, two bed and three bed?
Yeah, so for these apartments, the one beds are coming in at 1,000 per month, the two beds are coming in at 1,240 per month, and the three beds are coming in at 1,350 per month. So again, we feel that those are good rents to be offering. It's, you know, compared, looking at DAF this morning, there was only one bed property for rent. So to be able to bring 50 new homes to the market, we think is a great offering.
Yeah, and the paddocks development's quite conveniently located as well, from what I know, to sports clubs, social clubs, and it's very accessible to Dublin city centre as well, as we know, albeit we could do with extending the short hop zone out to Newbridge, but that's a conversation for a different day. With the eligibility criteria here, if anyone is listening thinking, I might be eligible for that, or am I eligible for it, just go through the criteria here to make sure that people meet these eligibility, I suppose, restrictions.
Yeah, so the main eligibility criteria are that after tax, your net income has to be 53,000 or less. So you also can't be in receipt of any social housing supports already, such as rent supplements or HAP. You can't own your own property already. And those are really it. Again, you have to be, I suppose, earning, and we'll have an affordability check to make sure that your income is going to be able to cover the rent that's on offer. But other than that, those are kind of the main criteria.
Okay, and finally then, as we said at the start as well, applications are open from today and they close on Wednesday the 3rd of August. How can people apply, and how is the process, I suppose, chosen then? How do people get picked for these cost rental homes?
Yeah, so anyone who's looking for other information, I suppose the advert is up on daf.ie, but I suppose the main source for information will be the Clwyd website, so that's www.clwyd.ie, and that's where you'll be able to apply. So if you go onto the Clwyd website, you'll find out further information, you'll be able to apply there. You'll also through our website, we have our web chat function. So if you wanted to, you know, maybe not pick up the phone, but you wanted to get a bit more information, there's a web chat option there. And then again, for anyone who does want to make a call into our office, it's 01-707-2088. And again, we have staff on hand who'd be happy to answer any questions. And as you say, application process is open for 1 week up until Wednesday, the 3rd of August. We earlier this year, we launched 46 apartments and we had over 800 people apply. So it really is proven to be very popular. Once the application process is finished, we'll then run a lottery system. And, you know, once you're selected through the lottery system, we'll then look for further information from you in terms of confirming eligibility, background reference checking. And after that, it'll be offering a tenancy if everything's in order.
Right, it is, as you say, a random selection system. It's automated and auditable, and that's to ensure a fair application process for all. David Murphy, new business manager with Clwyd Housing, thanks for joining us. 50 new cost rental homes open in the paddocks in Newbridge, and applications open from today. And to run through the eligibility criteria once again very briefly, you have to have a net household income below €53,000 per year. You're not in receipt of any social housing supports, that includes rent supplement or HAP. You don't currently own a property. The household size matches the size of the property advertised. Applicants can afford to pay the cost rent for the home, and household has only entered one application for a specific cost rental property. There are one bedroom apartments, two bedroom apartments and three bedroom apartments all on offer there, with rents approximately 25% to 30% below the local market value. As I say, have a look. You might be eligible. The Clwyd website, www.clwyd.ie, and you can check out more details there, and it's for the paddocks in Newbridge. Now, just before we move on to our next topic, some news making the headlines this morning and breaking, and Ciara has more on this. Ciara, two new studies point to Wuhan market for COVID origin. What is this about?
Yeah, well, obviously we were very lucky pre-December 2019 to live in a world pre-pandemic, without a pandemic. People want the answer. They want to know how this spread. They want to know how it began. And this animal market in China's Wuhan really was the epicenter, it's noted here, of the COVID-19 pandemic. That is according to a pair of new studies in the journal Science. It claims to have tipped the balance in the debate about the virus's origins. So they're answering the question of whether the disease spilled over naturally from animals to humans or was the result of a lab accident is viewed as vital to averting the next pandemic and saving millions of lives. So the first paper does analyse the geographic pattern of COVID-19 cases in the outbreak's first month. That was December 2019. It's showing the first cases were tightly clustered around the market in Wuhan, the animal market that is. The second examined genomic data from the earliest cases to study the virus's early evolution. It concluded it was unlikely the coronavirus circulated widely in humans prior to November 2019. Both were previously posted as preprints, but now have been vetted by scientific peer review and appear in a prestigious journal. So Dr. Michael Worby, he's of the University of Arizona over in the United States, and he co-authored both of the papers. He previously called on the scientific community in a letter to be more open to the idea that the virus was the result of a lab leak. The findings moved him to say, quote, to the point where now I also think it's not just plausible that this virus was introduced any other way than through the wildlife trade at the Wuhan market. Though previous investigation had centred on the live animal market, researchers wanted more evidence to determine if it really was the reason for the outbreak as opposed to an amplifier.
Yeah, that's it's quite interesting, I have to say. The required neighbourhood level study within Wuhan to be more certain the virus was zoonotic, that it jumped from animals to people. The first study's team used mapping tools to determine the location of most of the first 174 cases identified by the World Health Organization, finding 155 of them were in Wuhan. We'll keep an eye on that, and will be interesting to find the results of that survey and investigate investigation where exactly the COVID-19 virus originated from. Yeah, Ciara, just other things then as well before we move on. There's a couple of road closures in the county as well that just people need to be aware of today.
Yeah, so there's a temporary road closure on. It's at the Moat Lane and Town Hall Lane in Naas. So it closed from yesterday. So it's from the 26th of July, which was yesterday, to Tuesday, the 23rd of August. This is to facilitate public lighting upgrades, including associated civils works. So it's from the junction Moat Lane to Abbey Street. So 2 weeks, 14 days it will be closed for. And then the Town Hall Lane to the junction of the Main Street North. Again, 2 weeks it will be closed for diversionary routes. Clearly signposted in the area and alternative routes are available. You can find out more information there, of course, at kfmradio.com. And finally, before we go to your next topic, Owen, in regards to waterworks, there were quite a few around the county and the bordering areas of Wicklow over the past day or so. Kill, Ballymore Eustace, Hollywood across the border, Kilbride across the border, and Blessington across the border all had works yesterday, but they should all be repaired by now. But if you are affected in those areas or any others, get in touch with us here and we can find out more information for you. You can call me 045-898-999 or text or WhatsApp us here. It's 0833-97-97-97.
Yeah, we're going to take a break shortly, but I want to ask you the question, do you know what happened on this day 42 years ago here in Kildare? Some of you may have been there, some of you may have just been young while it happened, but you too played in Leixlip Castle on this day in 1980. Of course, they were supporting the police and a couple of other bands were there as well. It was part of the Dublin Festival, even though it didn't take place in Dublin, it took place in Leixlip. And we managed to find some audio of U2 playing at that festival. It was their first ever open-air concert to 15,000 people. There was also an incident with the police, not the Garda Síochána now, but the band on stage during the song Roxette, where somebody threw a bottle up at them. If anybody was at Leixlip Castle in 1980, get in touch with us. But here's music from U2. It's just a minute and a half. They were only very, very young, in their teens or maybe early 20s when they played this gig. Day, the 27th of July 1980, U2 played their first ever open air concert in Leixlip Castle in Leixlip, obviously as part of the Dublin Festival, in front of 15,000 people 42 years ago. Were you there? Let us know. 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Today
with Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie. Kildare
KFM. Now, HICWA have recommended a metabolic surgery programme as part of the type 2 diabetes treatment pathway. It's bariatric surgery. It involves changing how the stomach and small intestine process food. We're going to be discussing this morning with Dr. Conor Telhor. He is HICWA's chief scientist. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So tell me more about bariatric surgery.
So bariatric surgery, as you said, it changes how the stomach and the small intestines process food. So often it's like a restriction of the stomach, and it means that the patient can eat less at any one time, And they get less from the food, but it also means then that they lose weight. Now, specifically for people who have both type 2 diabetes and obesity, it can actually improve their diabetes control. So when you have diabetes, you tend to have too high blood sugar in your system. And over time, this causes all sorts of problems like increased blood pressure, and then there's an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. And it can lead to an awful lot of complications that are very serious for the patient. So by reducing somebody's weight, it can actually improve their diabetes control and then reduce the risk of all those various complications.
Connor, I've spoken a few times to a Newbridge-based GP here in the county, Dr. Brendan O'Shea, on the topic of overweight and obesity and bariatric surgery also. And people in this country, I believe, can avail of it within the public health system. How would that come about, if that makes sense? Tell me the process.
So at the moment, there is the provision of bariatric surgery in Ireland, but the resources are very limited, the capacity is limited, so it means that for a lot of people it's actually difficult to access. There's a long
wait
list.
Why is it limited, Connor?
It hasn't been set up as a program at the moment. So bariatric surgery there's an assessment process, they run assessment clinics, but they're limited in how many patients they can treat, and that's I suppose a question for the HSE. So what we were looking at was specifically the application of bariatric surgery to patients with type 2 diabetes and obesity. And so what we've advised is actually that they need to do it as a program of care, and that it needs to have the appropriate funding and the resources so that they can have the capacity to deal with the number of patients that are out there. Now, having said that, it's very difficult to determine what the demand is. So we've estimated that there are potentially 50,000 people who have type 2 diabetes and obesity, but only a small portion.
In the Republic?
In the Republic, yes. But what we are understanding is that actually only a small proportion of those would actually seek to go for metabolic surgery. Now, that's difficult to determine, and if it's introduced, then it's possible that demand will increase because awareness will increase. But it is only one of a range of treatments that's available to people with type 2 diabetes and obesity. So it may not be a first line of care. It may be that people consider it having first tried a number of other treatments and that they may then seek.
And Connor, I think people do understand that it's an option if you have, you know, seeked other types of treatment. But in terms of, you know, your role and things you would review when you go into when you publish reports like this, there has been a number of people who have travelled outside the country to receive surgery like this. Has that been something that has been taken into account by HICWA when publishing this report?
Yes, so we have looked at that, and concerns were particularly raised from a general practice perspective. So GPs like Brendan O'Shea might see patients from time to time who've gone abroad for bariatric surgery, and that they will come back to Ireland and they may then develop complications or issues arising from that surgery. And it's quite challenging to deal with because, you know, you don't necessarily know exactly what surgery that patient has received and what post-surgical care they've had. But we're looking very specifically at people with diabetes. And if people with diabetes travel abroad for bariatric surgery, it's being done not in the context of their diabetes, but purely in the context of them seeking bariatric surgery. If you have a program in Ireland, what's essential is that it's integrated into the various systems so that the patient is ideally referred from primary care, from their GP, into a hospital that they receive the treatment. And then when they're discharged from hospital, they come back into their GP and also into the community services, and that there's an understanding of what kind of supports they need. It's important for your listeners to appreciate that metabolic surgery, like bariatric surgery, it's not a one-time intervention that you go for surgery and then you have been treated and now you go back to normal life.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've had this surgery, you need long-term follow-up and long-term support.
So I just want to ask you about that, right? If somebody is listening and they have maybe received bariatric surgery in another country, and obviously it gets complicated, your follow-up then is not going to be the same if you've got it done in this country. Is it complicated then? Can it happen that they can be involved in a post program at all in this country? How would something like that work? Have HICWA, you know, reviewed and revised that, I guess, that those situations that are happening?
Well, no, because what we have looked at is very specifically what would happen if they introduced a program of care here and that patients would get end-to-end care.
So I do understand that, but my point is that some people who would have got the bariatric surgery abroad still do need the care. So, you know, where's the balance there? And what happens within the service then if this person is obese, has diabetes, has received bariatric surgery abroad, but does need some sort of care back in the country?
Well, at the moment, that is provided through general practice in Ireland. So GPs deal with their patients. And the challenge is that at the moment, if somebody comes back from abroad, as I said, it may not be clear, first of all, what type of surgery they had, and also what is happening with the patient. And an important aspect of metabolic surgery and bariatric surgery is that the long-term follow-up requires monitoring sort of nutrition of the patient and understanding the different levels in their blood for different essential components, and are they getting the vitamins, the minerals and everything that they need, because your absorption of minerals and nutrients changes after surgery. So for a GP, they need to know what they have to look for. So if they request blood tests, they need to know what they're asking for. Now, one of the aspects of having a program such as a metabolic surgery program is that there would be guidance on what you need to look for. And this would apply equally to patients, bariatric patients who've gone abroad and come back. So GPs would have better support in knowing what they need to test for and what they need to monitor in patients. But it's also worth emphasizing that, you know, we looked at a predicted demand of approximately 200 cases a year of metabolic surgery. Now, it could be higher or lower than that, but if it was 200 patients and we are talking about having in the region of 3,000 GPs in the country, it's only a small portion of GPs that will be dealing with patients with metabolic surgery. But the intention is, if we have a program, that you have this end-to-end care and that you integrate the care between the different settings, and therefore ensure that patients don't fall between the gaps, and that actually their care is managed across the board.
Okay, and Connor has said this HICWA report, which was published yesterday, noted the demand for metabolic surgery. It's difficult to predict, as not everyone with comorbid type 2 diabetes and obesity will want surgery or be a surgical candidate. And patients that do undergo it do require long-term follow-up. If it is the surgery provided by the HSE, it should be in the context of a programme providing end-to-end care. You can read the full report on HICWA's website, hicwa.ie, and that is HICWA's Chief Scientist, Dr. Connor Telhor. Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's go to local issues then. And on the line is Labour Councillor Mark Lee on the Athy Municipal District, because he brought a question or a motion forward with Ciara Galvin to the full council meeting recently. You wanted, Mark, first of all, good morning to you. You wanted the council to provide a breakdown of the current housing list figures for the county, including people availing of the HAP scheme. Why did you bring this forward and what response did you get?
Morning, Owen. I brought it forward because last month, as you remember, I brought forward day one for Athy MD, and we got a reaction, and I suppose a surprise reaction, Owen, on it, as to how many people were on the housing list in Athy especially. So, like, extending it out, we wanted to see how many was on the and list in the whole county, and to see where we were going in housing in Kildare with social housing, you know.
And did you get the figures then? So first of all, how many were on the housing list in Athy, and then countywide, how many do we have?
We had, we got the Housing for All Housing Delivery Action Plan figures from 2022 to 2026. Mm. And I'd like to thank the Housing Department and Kildare County Council for providing that. We have 6,500 units required for Kildare on 30% one bed, 30% two bed, 30% three bed, and 10% four bed is what's required. Some of the key figures I have, Athy is 916, Selbridge 612, Clane 281, Kildare 540, Kilcock 192, you know, it's going on and on. But
is
Newbridge 1,210, you know.
Is that units, Mark, or is that people on the housing list?
the oldest people on the housing list. But listen, right, there is units as well.
Go through those again for me.
I go through from top to bottom here for you. We have a tie on 916, Selbridge on 612, Plain on 281, Kildare on 540, Kilcock on 192, Kilcullen on 142, Leixlip on 334, Maynooth on 397, Monastrevin on 228, Naas on 954, Newbridge 1,210, Salins 146, and Castle Lerma is 111. Now that doesn't even include the villages, which is, you know, like I didn't get provided with that, but I know there is certain figures for certain villages around the Atai Municipal District, especially, you know.
What was the reaction, or what's your reaction to that? Because 6,500 on the waiting list is quite high. As you said there, 950-odd in Newbridge and then are in Naas and over 1,000 in Newbridge. It wouldn't fill people with confidence if they had to go on the housing list, because you're going to be on it for a considerable amount of time, are you not?
Yeah, well, Clem, on the housing delivery action, or, sorry, I called you Clem. On the housing delivery action plan, by 2026, the aim is to reach 2,200 houses built or leased in County Kildare by the council. So still a shortfall of 4,300. And we're only plodding along. And you find by 2026, the same amount of people will be on the list, if not more, with inflation and costs the way they're rising. So it's absolutely no fault of Kildare County Council, I may add. This is all government-led. I didn't speak much to the motion, as my party colleagues, Councillor Feeney, Councillor Breen and Councillor Breslin, had a motion just before me.
Mm.
Asking that Kildare County Council write a letter to the Minister for Housing to say how dissatisfied we are as councillors and how intolerable the housing situation in County Kildare is currently. And I think Angela actually captured the zeitgeist of the housing pandemic, you could call it, in County Kildare excellently, with a very impassioned speech. And I don't want to impinge on her motion too much, Owen, because no doubt you have her on to speak about it herself. But yeah, it was voted down by the government parties on the day, and I just think that was shocking, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that motion
they don't seem to think that there's a problem.
Yeah, they wanted this is Angela Feeney, Anne Breen and Aoife Breslin, wanted the council to support the Raise the Roof campaign by writing to the Minister for Housing calling for urgent action through legislation if necessary to address the current housing emergency and growing levels of homelessness in the county. That was voted down. Right. And how many people are homeless then? Because those that are on the housing list, I'm assuming, are not the amount of people who are necessarily homeless in the county. But nonetheless, it's still quite high, 6,500 on that homeless list, or on the housing list.
Yeah, 6,500. No, I haven't got the figures for homelessness at the moment,
right,
Owen. But as of last year, we had 64 homeless beds. Now, this is not counting anybody that's couch surfing or staying in their mother's box room or, you know, anything like that. So we don't actually know at the moment, I think, is the honest answer to that one.
Okay, well, with that breakdown of the various different towns around the county with the amount of people who are on that housing list, that is Labour Councillor Mark Lee of the Atai Municipal District. He raised that issue at the full council meeting on Monday. And Mark, thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. Interesting figures.